Test Talks, Episode 1. Hit it.
Welcome to the Test Talks Podcast, the place to go to geek out on software testing. And now your host, whose mission is to help you succeed with test automation, Joe Colantonio.
Hello, 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 and welcome to Test Talks, a weekly podcast dedicated to all things related to test automation. I'm your host, Joe, from joecolantonio.com, and this is the very first episode of Test Talks. Today, we're going to head over to the Temple of Heaven in China to talk with Lance Kind about behavior-driven development. Apparently, Temple of Heaven is just a Holiday Inn in China, but it still sounds pretty cool. So today, Lance is really going to illuminate a lot of things for us about BDD. So if you really want to find out what Harry Potter and steampunk have to do with BDD, make sure to listen all the way to the end. Check it out. I'm really excited today to be speaking with Lance Kind about behavior-driven development. Lance is an agile BDD consultant extraordinaire, a sci-fi author, and an all-around cool guy. Hey, Lance, welcome to Test Talks.
Thanks, Joe. Hey, what a great introduction. I'm going to have to work pretty hard to live up to that reputation.
So before we get started, Lance, why don't you just tell us a little bit more about yourself?
Well, I've been doing agile software development since 1999. And my first coach was Kent Beck. We were at Hewlett-Packard, and we were doing typical waterfall development until 1999. And my lab manager was friends with Kent and hired him to come and work with us. And so since then, I've been doing extreme programming and Scrum oftentimes with extreme programming to deliver projects. So I have the unusual circumstance of almost never being involved on a maintenance project. Most of my colleagues or most of the people I work with have been having to maintain. They've had that role where they've had to maintain an existing software system and handle lots of bugs and calls from customer support and maintain a list of bugs that they may or may not resolve. Until management says, yes, you can resolve this. It's almost never happened in my career. The one time where I did inherit a project that had a bug tracking system, it had roughly 100 and some bugs, which is actually kind of small for a lot of projects. And it was until we started, it was always growing a little bit more every year. And after a year, it was about down to 4. So I've been very happy with my career in that I didn't have to be stuck with just, you know, fixing bugs for a number of months after a release.
Excellent. So how would you explain behavior-driven development to a newbie, someone that's never heard of it before?
So I guess I would say this. We're going to describe what the software does at a high level, and we're going to write down a number of scenarios, ways that the software will be used and how it should behave. So maybe those are the 2 or 3 sentences I need to say to start the conversation.
Great. So once someone understands what BDD is, how do you actually go about training them how to do behavior-driven development?
For me, training people on this, it's a lot like teaching something like calculus. How do you explain a newbie why they should do calculus? It's pretty challenging. And it takes a little time. It takes an investment of time for me and that person to work together for a bit, for a couple hours, and then they'll leave with this new practice, and then they'll go try to apply it to their product backlog, and they'll need a little more help with that. But after a while, they'll get it. So it's something you have to do for a while to get it going.
Awesome. So Lance, you just mentioned that, you know, it takes time to get BDD actually going in an organization for everyone to be on board. So why do you think BDD is actually worth the effort to do?
You know, the behavior-driven development is a really cool process. It's something I've come into later in my career. And it's good to see that there's some advancements over and above the extreme programming practices, for example. Behavior-driven development is cool because it creates a little bit of formalization, given some circumstance happens, precondition, when some circumstance happens, then I should have some kind of effect. When you force yourself, and honestly, at first you struggle, to create a scenario that describes what you want the software to do using that framework, it forces you to think at a higher abstract level. And that level is free from implementation. So at the product ownership level, when you're thinking free from implementation, you're thinking more like the customer who knows very little about implementation.
So what would you say is the benefit of actually doing that?
By doing that, you are freeing yourself of all these preconceptions about how you think the solution should be, and purely thinking about solving the customer's problem. And that's honestly getting to the point. Some people think getting to the point is being very clear on this implementation. For example, given the user has a password on the system, when they enter their username and password, then the system lets them log in. They think that that's a very clear and specific behavior. But the end user really doesn't care. The end user probably doesn't want to type in their password. The end user probably doesn't want to deal with that implementation detail. They would rather just be able to have the system. They would rather, if I phrase this in a different way, given that I'm an authorized user, when I'm identified to the system, then I can log in. So no, I'm no longer talking about username and passwords. I can now think about other ways to do this, other ways to solve this problem. Some companies create really amazing products that people didn't predict. For example, think about the new iPhone 5S. It doesn't require you to type in a PIN number to use your phone. It now has the biometrics touch on the button. So if their product ownership had always been anchored to thinking about what's existing today and how do we use what's existing today to make the user happy, they may not have stepped back a little bit and thought about, well, no, how really can we make the user happy with some new innovation? The developers now are also being forced by the language we're using to think more abstract. Now the challenge of BDDs, that's uncomfortable for everyone because they're not used to that. Certainly the developers are used to getting what's called imperative specifications. They're used to being told, you know, you need to have a login page, you need to have a you have to have the user use passwords. Maybe the passwords require a number and a letter and a strange symbol. You know, all of these things are basically being micromanaged at the user requirement what to do. And the product ownership is often used to being told to do this, so much so that they just provide that as a habit. So there's a lot of habits that people have now around imperative requirements that when they start going to BDD, that they are hard to break.
Right. Because I even see people beginning BDD thinking of, you know, as a user, I want to hover my mouse over an image. And that's really not behavior. A user doesn't care about hovering a mouse over an image, I don't think. So
right.
I think it is a total change of a mindset when you get into it. But once you get into it, like you said, it really clears up a lot of confusion that you might have. And really, you want to make sure you're building the best software possible for the user that's going to be using it, I think is probably the main goal.
Right. And I think you said it very well. If the user doesn't care about mouse hovering, the user cares about whatever that behavior is that the hovering is giving them. And maybe if the UI is less confusing, they won't even need to hover because the UI will just give them the information they need at a glance.
Yeah.
So when we cut away those implementation details, it allows us to think higher and more abstract. Now I want to get more, a little further down to one of your points was earlier was that, well, by what you said earlier was by using behavior-driven development, we think of scenarios that we didn't otherwise think of. That is true because we're at a more abstract level and we don't know what the implementation is. We don't know what the implementation is. Now we have to think about those behaviors that the user wants. Let's back up to that earlier example. What do we do if there's an unauthorized user, a newly unauthorized user? He used to be authorized, now he becomes unauthorized. What do we do when that happens? Do we shut down the system or do we just kick off the user? You could think of there's several things you might want to happen. If the system is in charge of say some kind of weapons launch, you might treat that differently. Then if they are, let's see, versus a email system. If they're using an email system and they're unauthorized, you could simply kick them off. But if they're in a weapons launch scenario, there may be some transactional things we need to think about. Did the user already start a stream of commands to arm weapons and ready them for launching? And once they're kicked off, maybe we should roll back those stream of commands since the point they logged in. And so that's the kind of conversation we want the team to have. You wouldn't have that conversation if you're being told exactly what to do.
Lance, yeah, I think that's a great point. And that's the beauty of BDD. It's the actual conversations that we're having. That's the true benefit of BDD. Having these conversations and finding out these different requirements that we may not have known without the conversations before we even start coding. So I definitely agree with you. So how do you get buy-in from teams? I know you do a lot of consulting and you probably go into a lot of different situations. Have you ever had pushback? And like, how do you get over that to say like if a developer, what's in it for me as a developer, say, to do this process, to do BDD?
Right. Well, totally. And there's always some pushback. Because at all levels, it depends how big the change is. Now, BDD is a big change. It's a cross-functional practice. Test-driven development is a developer change, not cross-functional practice. System test automation is a QA process change. Generally, it's a QA team that does it, or it could be development team, but generally, it's a QA team that does it. So that's not cross-functional. But once you start talking about BDD, now you're talking about product ownership, source of requirements, even higher than product ownership, potentially, all the way down to each person on the team, developer and tester, and other whoever else you need. Each person on the team now has to behave differently. So that's actually... the more roles it touches, the more chances it causes people to push back and say no. So what's in it for the developer? The developer is going to say, you know, I'm really busy already, Lance. I got all this work to do, and you're saying I should now implement some test automation using this technology for BDD. And, you know, of course, you will say, what's in it for me? I don't want to look bad here. I want to be successful. I want to have the bonus for Christmas. I don't want my boss getting mad at me because I really feel, you know, he'll tell me this. He'll say, I really feel that I'll be moving slower by implementing all this automation than just writing more functionality. And that's a big step because I will tell people this. Because it's true. I've done zero bug releases. I've done releases with only one or two bugs. And sometimes we had a bug that we had to fix, but we could fix it within 2 or 3 days. We just fix a bug and run all our automation and then re-release. People have trouble believing that because they love that vision, but they don't know how to get there.
Right.
Well, one of the ways to get there is honestly to do less of something else. the less of something else is less debugging. Debugging is a big source of waste in our development processes. So this developer who says to me, Lance, why should I change why should I do this extra automation effort? Because he says, I feel it'll take away from time to do development. Mm-hmm. Is to get that person to realize how much waste is in his existing process. So most developers, when they say they're implementing a new feature, sort of imagine that they're every stroke of the keyboard is creating some kind of gold for the company to sell later. Every stroke of the keyboard is creating some value. So the first step is again to recognize the waste that is actually happening while they work. Most common of the developers I interview realize after talking with me that 50% of their effort is spent using the debugger, generally doing either manual unit testing using the debugger or debugging some problem that occurred while they're implementing the feature. And the other, say, 50% is done actually writing code, writing the new feature. So there's at least 50% waste in their ability to implement new features. If we can take away that 50% waste, so they spent 8 hours, 4 of that hours is spent unit testing, manual unit testing or debugging. If we can reduce that, drive that towards zero, and instead create something else that we can check, we can create an automated test that we can check into source control, then that's an investment that can be used in the future whenever there's a question on the how healthy the product is. So that's one way, is to explain to them, look, you already have a bunch of waste here that you're not recognizing because you're just used to doing your work this way. You're used to using debuggers a lot. But we're going to do less of that, and we're going to show you a process where we're going to create code step by step and tests for that code. And that code, that test code will actually check in so that every time you touch the code, you can reuse those tests, which will give you some value in the future. But these manual unit tests or the use of the debugger, that's not an artifact. You're not creating an artifact. You're just doing work that's one off. You're creating throwaway work.
So the benefit is, so BDD really is also about, once you have these scenarios set up, that you can then automate these scenarios. And so they're saving time by having these things automated. So when they check in the code into the CI build tool, it'll run these tests and they'll get instant feedback on whether or not the application broke or not. And thus spend less time in, you know, debugging and doing all these other manual processes because it's been automated. Is that the gist of it?
Yeah, that's right. And maybe the instant feedback is not so instant. It might be hours to days to run all your BDD tests, but that'll be hours to days, which will be much faster than after somebody checked in a bug. I mean, we check in bugs. Those bugs don't get into source control by themselves. We check in bugs, and maybe it takes days to weeks before we realize that there's a bug if we're doing a manual testing process, or maybe even months. So BDD is a huge order of magnitude faster on bug detection. But there's two values to BDD. There's the higher level thinking and creation of new scenarios, and then there's the ability to create test automation. And you don't necessarily have to do the test automation. You could just choose not to do the test automation, and maybe the value of being clear on what it is you're building is really great by itself. Some people, when they say BDD, they always mean test automation. But there are people out there in the world who are just using BDD for requirements collection because of the value of having better requirements and still do the manual test processes and those other things.
Oh, that's a great point. So I actually was going to bring it up. Is BDD equal to automation? So actually what we're saying is the benefit is BDD does not equal automation. It's not a side effect, but it's one of the artifacts that are created when you do BDD, but it's not the goal of BDD. The goal of BDD is not test automation, right? Would you say that?
Yeah, I would totally say that, because if you just want to test automation, why do BDD?
Yeah, I think that's a great point, because for some reason, I meet a lot of people that for some reason just equate BDD with automation as all your scenarios shall be automated. They start having these requirements like we'll have 100% automation, and it's hard to sometimes break that type of thinking because it's almost like a magic bullet that we have all these scenarios will be automated, and it's just hard to fight that kind of thinking.
And you know what? They might not be doing behavior-driven development once they do that. Mm. They might be doing system testing using given when thens that are not very behavioral.
Right.
And then what that means is every time there's a requirements change, talk about the mouse hover example you said earlier, given we're going to speak in non-BDD terms here for a moment. I'm searching for something in my system. When I hover the mouse over an icon, then a pop-up occurs. A pop-up comes up that tells me more about the properties of that icon. And so later, when the user says, "You know what? This is really hard to use. Maybe I want to," let's say later he doesn't want to use a mouse interface. He wants to use a touchpad. Well, heck, now all of our BDD tests are out of date because they talk about mousing around instead of finger gestures.
Right.
And so now what do we do? Well, now we have a bunch of maintenance to do on something because we're so detailed. And if we're too detailed, we'll actually create more work for us later.
Right. So it's almost like some people almost make it BDD as like an automation front end, like a framework that they use to drive their automation test rather than, a traditional real use of BDD.
I don't think there's a lot of value in talking about given when thens with implementation details. Why do I feel like that? Because number one, the negative value is right away you're going to have more maintenance every time those specific details change.
Right.
So if the mouse hovers for 5 seconds, the pop-up comes up. Oh, what if later we need to change that time to 3 seconds? Now I got to go update my tests I got to update my scenarios to reflect that new change. But why are we being so specific? We could write given when that that are extremely detailed and going to create a lot of maintenance for us.
So basically that type of detail should be pushed way down the stack. So you should create, I guess, your BDDs in layers almost. So your BDDs would be at a nice high level, your scenarios, and then all those technical details would be kind of hidden away in maybe a function library or some methods, helper methods for those.
BDD implementations, there's this word called step functions. So it should be in the Java code, it should be in the .NET code, where it decides what those implementation details are. And later, if those details do change, then we have to update the Java code, but we don't have to fiddle with our scenarios. So that means the QA professionals, if they're the ones generating whoever wrote the scenarios, let me be very abstract about roles here. Whoever wrote those scenarios doesn't have to update the scenarios, just the code has to be updated.
And so it's another thing that saves time if you create your tests at the right level, is that if you had 100, like thousands of tests, the implementation usually is done in one particular method. You only need to change that one place if there is a change. So I guess it also would help with maintenance and making your tests less brittle in the long run.
Absolutely.
Okay.
In fact, if you do BDD badly, maybe you will end up costing more to do the test maintenance than it would to do the manual testing.
That's another great point, Lance, because I've been on a lot of projects where they've done automation, and especially if you're using BDD and you're doing a lot of automation with the BDD scenarios, that it takes a long time to fix if they're not done right. So the maintenance is a big problem, I think, if you're doing bad BDD. Now, in all your consulting gigs, is there anything you see that most organizations or people trying to practice BDD are doing wrong? Is there like one thing that you think that if people right off the bat knew about before they implemented BDD, that the better off they'll be down the road?
Totally. Here's how I see it, is when I do a Google search for BDD and I look at examples, mm-hmm. and a lot of the examples include implementation details, they're not actually BDD. There are some that are correct, but there's the majority of them have things like button clicks and mouse clicks, and they have a lot of implementation details. They're not actually behavioral. So people who created those examples and are sharing those on the internet, they're trying to be helpful, but the problem is they're still stuck in that imperative specification mindset.
Right.
And unfortunately, that's promulgating, if I'm going to use an old-fashioned word here, promulgating the practice of imperative specifications using give and then rather than behavior.
Mm-hmm. So people, you know, we want to do a more declarative style of writing our BDDs, not an imperative style. We're not writing for a computer that's reading a recipe. We're writing for people, you know, almost.
And totally.
Okay.
Yeah, and that's a good point. Let's talk about that for a moment. So your release management team or your program manager aren't thinking about mouse hovers and clicks, I suspect. Mm-hmm. Now, I could be wrong. There are some very detailed people that carry lots of details in their head across a large scope because that's what they've done all of their lives and they're very good at it. But most people are not like that. And in fact, the customer who's buying your product doesn't know that when he hovers the pointer over an icon, that in 3 seconds something will pop up. He's not really buying that. He doesn't mm-hmm. care.
Right.
The customer cares about some effect that this is going to have on his business, which is valuable. And I'm sure it has nothing to do with the mouse hover. So BDD should be like the box. When you go to an electronic store, like Best Buy, for example, and you pick up a box and you're going, huh, I wonder what's in here. And of course, the marketing of the box will tell you the name, the company, and it'll also tell you about some of the features. Mm-hmm. And those features will be something that they can tell you in about 10 bullet points. And those 10 bullet points won't include details such as mouse hovering. but they will say, like if you're buying a router, for example, it'll say, hey, it'll go, you know, so fast, all right? There's a non-functional requirement there. and it will be secure, right? And it may say what, because this detail is important, it may say what type of security. It may be, say, WPA2 security. Mm-hmm. So that'll have very high-level features that you're using to sell the product. And because that's what whoever put the product together felt that the market really values the most. So they had to put expose the top 10 features on that box to tell the user what it is they want. And the user makes a buy decision. So in BDD, what we're putting are given when thens. You'll probably have more than 10 in our case. Well, you know, you may have hundreds of them. I don't know if you'll have thousands, but you'll have hundreds. Yep. And, the language in those given when thens should be something high level enough that the user can understand. And in fact, it should be something high level enough that the user's boss can understand. The boss, the person who's funding the purchase of the equipment. So in that case, the user's boss probably doesn't actually even use the application. He just knows what his staff needs. He knows what his staff needs are and what they want. And he doesn't know whether they use a mouse. He doesn't know if they use finger gestures. He doesn't know if they're using voice commands. But he knows that they need these things to get some work done. And he knows at a high level what those are. So those given when thens are something that the user's boss understands. The user may actually, if you wrote on the box, hey, if you hover for 3 seconds, a pop-up will happen. They may know that. They may. Not necessarily, you know, we're not guaranteed, but they may know that. But the boss certainly doesn't because he doesn't use the software. And they're not buying the software because of the hover. They're buying the software because of the value. And so your given when then should be abstract enough that the user's boss understands the feature set.
All right. So it's So you're really trying to talk about the benefits, you know, almost, rather than the specific features sometimes.
Yeah, and I think that's huge. I think that's a huge change in mindset because as a developer, I'm a developer who also does automation. So maybe I'm also a QA pro as well. As somebody who builds software, let's put it that way. Sometimes I don't know the value of the feature I'm creating because I don't know the user. I don't know the context in which they're using it. Mm-hmm. I've just been told, hey, you need to do this and this because this is what the user wants. And I go, okay, and I build it. And that kind of sucks because you know what? Sometimes when you're given your orders that way, you later find out that it doesn't actually give them the value they want because there was some misunderstanding or miscommunication. And so the more we know the user's context, the better we can build our software.
So it's almost like once you know the benefit, you probably would say, okay, now I kind of know the type of features, rather than someone saying, here's a list of features you need. If you knew up front what the benefit was, then you could kind of work backwards to what features would make that benefit happen.
Absolutely. You know, one of my favorite examples of this is jackets. Let's talk about designing a jacket, because everybody has one. But there's actually some very specialized jackets. My snowboarding jacket has a very long pull tab on the zipper. And the reason why it has a long pull tab on the zipper is because it can be operated wearing mittens. I can open my jacket and close my jacket without taking off my mittens. So there's a very technical reason why it's designed that way. Yep. But if you don't tell somebody, hey, design me a jacket that somebody can operate with gloves, if you don't tell them that, mm-hmm. You're probably not going to get what you need. And maybe you can be clever. Maybe you could say, well, I know this. My user, I'm the product owner right now, and I know my users are going to be wearing mittens. And so the glove, the pull tab on the zipper needs to be about 2 or 3 inches long. And so I could tell my jacket maker this and not tell them about why they want it like that way. And chances are they'll do exactly what I told them. They'll give me a pull tab that's 2 or 3 inches long, but then they won't realize that the ski jackets have a flap that cover the zipper, and chances are that flap won't be designed so they can actually get to the zipper with the mitten. So my jacket has a special kind of flap as well, so that I can snap it shut or open it wearing gloves, and there's a lot of room for error if the product owner in this case either needs to speak behaviorally to bring the manufacturer into the context of the user so that they know why what it is they're building. They know specifically, not just if they just have the imperative specification of the pull tab, they're going to miss something. They're completely reliant on the product owner getting every detail right.
Right.
And not only right, but completely understood by the manufacturer, meaning maybe the pull tab is 3 inches long, but maybe it's too wide, or maybe there's some other problem that actually they can't system test it with gloves, because they don't know that the users are wearing gloves. They're just making it to the specification that they're told to.
That's a great point.
You know, in the software industry, we've made all these roles. We've made QA professionals, QA professionals, we have developers, we have product owners. What some companies have done is that the only people who think about how to test it are the QA pros. They'll know about the user wearing gloves,
right.
For example. But the developers won't. The people who make the pull tabs won't even know. They'll just get it. They're gonna. It has to be 3 inches. And then later, at some testing phase, the QA pros go, "Hey, wait a minute! You can't open this jacket up with gloves. You failed the test." And the developers are like, "What? Oh, we didn't know they're wearing gloves. It's completely. There's a silo. The information has been siloed.
Right.
And that's a wasteful process at that point.
So that's another thing that BDD frees up. You get everyone in the same room up front first before anything's written, and those types of things would come out. You know, hey, they're going to be wearing gloves, and the QA would be able to share those type of insights with the developers before the developers even write any code. So
absolutely, we don't want did some training, a little bit of training on BDD recently, and it was kind of funny because one of the values of BDD and the cross-role communication is that now the QA pros have the chance to keep the developers from making the same mistake over and over again, because we're going to be in the room together and we're going to discuss these things together. And now we can cut out a lot of our waste that comes out of not understanding things. And if your bottleneck, the process is, say, if you're doing manual testing, it's how much you can test. You want to find a way to move the QA part to the front of the process. So for example, test-driven development means you write the unit tests before you write the code.
Yep.
Okay, that's exactly that. You're putting the bottleneck, which is all the testing that happens at the end of our waterfall process, put it to the front. In BDD, we're doing the same thing too. We're getting the checking the specification. I don't want to say imperative specification, but at a high level, our plan or our specification, what we're going to build, we're checking at the very beginning in our sprint planning, and we're talking about it already. Where in the old days, we wouldn't talk about it till the months down the road or a year down the road. We're going to talk about that and see if it looks right and inspect it. And then we're going to, after the planning meeting, we're then going to implement it in reverse too. We're going to implement the automation of the test first before the code's written, before the feature's written. Mm-hmm. So yeah, absolutely. You're totally right on the money. And that was so anytime you're faced with a problem, once you find the bottleneck, you try to think of a way to bring it to the front of the assembly line. Because otherwise, if you don't do that, what you end up with is a lot of inventory. So if you just develop code, write code, and then later test it at the end of your assembly line, and you don't have enough time to do all the testing, that means you have excess inventory of features that you can't test, and you don't know if they work well. So you ship it untested and let the customers test it for you because you carried what's called inventory. You've carried extra things that you can't actually execute your plan on.
Well, Lance, I know it's getting near an hour now. I don't want to keep you any longer. It's been a great conversation. I'm probably going to follow up with you later. I know your colleague Wes might be on a later show.
Cool.
So before we go, though, are there any resources or books that you can recommend to someone learning BDD?
I really liked Bridging the Chasm by, and I'm not going to get his name right. It's spelled in English, but if you read his name, it's Gojko.
Cool. I've actually heard a lot of great things about that book. If people are looking for it on Amazon, I think the full title is Bridging the Communication Gap, Specification by Example, and Agile Acceptance Testing. So before we go, is there one more piece of advice you can give someone who's implementing BD now, something they can do right away that they can actually take away and implement right away that will help their BDD process? And also let us know what's the best way to contact you, or are there any websites we can go to learn more about you and your business or the books that you write?
The main thing, the first thing I would do if I was starting to do BDD is after I write my grid given, can I implement this behavior using Steam? So what I'm saying here is if I have a given one that has button clicks and mouse clicks, obviously I need a mouse. I can't use Steam technology. I'm going steampunk here. But if the behavior that you're describing is implementation detail free, then you could make it work using Steam. So I'm throwing that out there for the steampunks. You could say magic too. If you're into Harry Potter, you could say, well, can I make this using magic? Is there anything here that, but if you're talking about button clicks and hovers, you're not going to be able to implement this feature using Steam. But if you're talking about behaviors, you could create a nice little steampunk engine for that.
Very cool.
So there's that. And then, so what am I working on nowadays? I'm working on a book on Agile called Agile Noir. It's about a project manager who's working on a project for a casino in Vegas, who finds out his project's being funded by the mob. So when he starts slipping his dates, the hitmen start coming after him, and he has to try to survive. He's forced to learn to survive by starting down the road of using Scrum for his project. And where can you learn more about that? So LancerKind.com is my website. It has a lot of my writing projects on it. I'm still in the works, Joe, on my BDD website. I say it's in the works, but I've been like crazy busy. I've been billable for the last two and a half months. So I haven't had much time to work on it. And I run into technical problems. I have to do some real engineering work, not just systems integration, to fix up my site. But there will be an announcement on a site that's designed to solve the problem that I'm talking about with BDD, about being too implementation dependent. So I'm going to create I'm working on a site whose feature will be to allow you to learn about what given when thens look like, what kinds of given when thens you don't want to have, and what kinds of given when thens that you do want to have. And sorry, it's not ready yet.
I can't wait. That's a great resource. I think it's really going to help a lot of people. So we're definitely going to keep a tab on that.
Right. Well, thank you, Joe. I do have another site that has some BDD things on it called, it's a big URL, it's called confessionsofanagilecoach.blogspot.com that has, usually it's inspired by something I've run into in my dream consulting of a problem that I think a lot of other people have, and I go ahead and write an article about it up there. And there's a couple things on there about BDD and how to be implementation free. Keep our BDD implementation free, awesome. Joe. It's like keeping the mercury
That's
out of
right.
our food. You know, it's a good thing.
Absolutely. All right, Lance. Thanks again for all your time. This has been great. I think I have some really good stuff here, so I'm really excited. I really appreciate your time.
Absolutely, Joe. It's great talking to you. I love working with you. So, I really admire the work you're doing online on that website of yours as well. So, please keep up the fight. It's the right fight and a good fight.
Cool. Thanks so much, Lance. And that's it for this episode of Test Talks. Thanks for listening. If you want more information on the links and resources mentioned in this episode, head on over to testtalks.com/1. And remember, test everything, keep the good.
Thanks for listening to the Test Talks podcast. Head on over to www.testtalks.com for full show notes, amazing blog articles, and other automation awesomeness.